If you leave those flowers under the sun for too long after they have bloomed, your saffron is going to lose most of its original aroma and taste. It diminishes the quality of your saffron, as if the aroma of the saffron gets released into the air and disappears forever. That's what I'm told. You have to pick the buds with the longest stems, and you have to do it fast. There is no alternative to the human hand when it comes to picking these flowers. No machines, no automatons, no nothing. The men and women of the village spend hours squatting or doubling down while picking the flowers. The cold weather and the time crunch on the one hand, and the pressure on the farmers' knees and backs on the other, make the job ever more difficult. The tips of the fingers tingle from the bitter cold, and nagging pain starts to be felt in the knees and back. The work is agonizing and toilsome. Desert dwellers are tough human beings, and do not easily give up in the face of the difficulties presented to them by life. These people's entire being is made up of hope and love of life. They are eternally grateful to God, even when doing the most difficult of work. The young people, too, hum local songs as they work. After spending only a couple of hours with Amir and his family on their farm, I'm completely worn out. The pain in my back and knees is excruciating, but I feel great, because during those 3 hours, I got to see firsthand what these hard-working people go through. I can feel their pain. But there's something that upsets me and all of Iran's saffron farmers. Unfortunately, the farmers do the lion's share of the work in producing saffron. A case in point is the back-breaking harvesting process, but it's the middleman who stands to make most of the profit. That's an issue that calls for proper management and careful planning. The farmers need help to cash in on the result of their hard work, to make a profit that makes it all worth their while. Another big problem is a lack of proper, internationally interesting packaging industry in Iran for exporting saffron. A country like Spain is making the best of this opportunity. It buys Iran's high-quality saffron at a very low price, puts it in beautiful, modern packaging, and re-exports it to other countries in its own name and at a much higher price. The margin of profit is staggering, and that's what the farmers here have been complaining about. I am depressed after watching the farmers work so hard and hearing out their problems. But Amir has a present for me to cheer me up. To refresh themselves and shake off the cold after the working hours, the farmers get together somewhere next to their farms and brew themselves some fresh tea laced with fresh saffron in a pot on fire made from dry sticks. Locals here believe that saffron tea cheers you up. It makes you laugh. It helps freshen you up. But for someone like me, the question that comes to mind is, how can you not be happy when you hang around with such hardworking, kind, pure souls? How can you sit down with these folks, sip saffron tea with them, and not be filled with joy? The fact is that even without this tea, saffron tea I mean, you get filled with peace and happiness when you hang around with people who spend all day, from morning till evening, doing back-breaking work. Cheers. After imbibing that delicious saffron-flavored tea one sip at a time, I decide to sit down with one of the elders of Esfandiar, and that is none other than Mr. Danai. He tells me about the desert people's frugal existence, about their simple lifestyle, about the tough days of famine many years ago, and the perseverance and resilience of his fellow villagers in the face of the vicissitudes of life. The farmers don't have any time to waste. Therefore, after picking the flowers, they usually sit down together and start the next phase of saffron production, which is plucking the stigmas from the flowers. That's why I believe those who live in deserts or near them are very patient people. See for yourself. Take a look around. It took a lot of patience for them to turn this steep surface into a terraced farmland. Then, with a lot of hardship, they planted the saffron bulbs in it, spent months attending to them and waiting for them to yield. As far as I know, saffron crocuses bloom once a year. It takes a lot of elbow grease to cultivate them. They don't need much water, but still growing them is no walk in the park. Everything about saffron requires a lot of hard work and patience. That's why I've come to believe that desert dwellers are very stoic. Whatever they do calls for a lot of patience, and if they aren't patient, things won't happen. They won't prosper. The pain Mr. Amiri has in his knees and back is a pain that everybody here shares. All these people work really hard on these farms. And as I say, those living in desert climates are super patient human beings. Being in their company gives you the kind of peace that defies description. The last stage in the production of saffron involves spreading the stigmas on a proper surface and leaving them to dry. And that's a job that has to be done with a lot of care and skill. Otherwise, the quality of the end product will be impacted. In the end, the middlemen come to the villages, buy the dried saffron from the farmers, and sell it at staggering prices after proper packaging. I have high hopes for this beautiful village to be reconstructed and renovated. I hope that on my next trip to Esfandiar, I see many tourists here. There aren't many places on Earth that share the same natural, architectural, agricultural, and anthropological variety as Esfandiar's. But unfortunately, those beautiful houses you see behind me, although they used to be people's homes one day, now lay in ruins. No one is paying adequate attention to all the historical, cultural, and architectural beauties of our beloved country. I'm sure each one of those houses in this beautiful mountainous region, with all these vast terraced saffron farms and its beautiful gardens, not to mention its very hospitable residents, I'm sure if they are renovated, they can act as hotels in this region to accommodate tourists coming from other countries and, of course, local tourists traveling to this region. They can become beautiful hotels offering peaceful moments to those staying at them. My trip to South Khorasan has come to an end. I'm leaving with beautiful memories and valuable knowledge of this region of Iran. Before setting out for this part of the country from the capital city, I wouldn't even dream of such spectacular scenery and such kind human beings. I traveled to this area to see the saffron crocuses growing in the desert. I found the beauties of South Khorasan as a treasure trove, each of which is as beautiful as Iran's famed saffron. All this area needs to turn it into a major tourist attraction is proper attention and management on the part of government officials. And all that is possible if the traditional lifestyle of the folks living here does not undergo any radical changes, and provided the untouched scenery in these areas is not despoiled by modern residential and industrial structures. The beautiful face of deserts and the wilderness, the sand dunes and mountains, the animal and plant species living in deserts, an unpolluted blue sky, clean air, beautiful, vacant yet livable villages, the farms and gardens of the area, and on top of them all, the genuine and hospitable people with a rich culture. Each and every one of them is as precious as the saffron produced in the desert of South Khorasan. All I wish for is for all these assets to be preserved and protected for future generations.
Perhaps next time you'll enjoy another Persian dish with the exquisite scent of saffron, you will remember the terraced saffron farms of Esfandiar and the kind and hard-working farmers who plant the little purple flowers and harvest strands of red gold. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. But before we go, remember you can contact us either through email, Facebook, or Twitter. Goodbye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Dear listeners, this is an article, a critical look at Biden's first executive orders set against the backdrop of Operation Peaceful Transition in Washington, D.C., written by Eleanor Goldfield Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "Despite What You Heard, There Was No Peaceful Transition." Stay tuned. Anyone trying to find the edges of the U.S. overturn window right now must feel like they're tracing an amateur rendition of an early Picasso. After a summer spent chanting defund the police, self-identifying progressives applaud the pouring of some 25,000 troops and busloads of out-of-city law enforcement into the streets of Washington, D.C. Those eager to cheer the departure of a racist, war-hawking elitist from the White House were quick to welcome a new racist, war-hawking elitist. Those who lambasted Trump for dragging more swamp creatures into the swamp rather than draining it are applauding Biden for his diverse cabinet appointments, ignoring the revolving door of corruption and oppression they represent. Those who correctly decried the Paris Climate Agreement for being flimsy and non-committal are celebrating Biden's executive order to rejoin it. Indeed, anyone applauding Biden's first flicks of the wrist as president would do well to look beyond the window dressing. Of the 15 new executive orders that aren't merely a light Trump eraser, they herald a return of the classic Democratic practice of a sprinkling progressive tasting garnish around deep systematic problems. For example, Biden's executive order to once again kill the Keystone XL pipeline project, a project that Obama had already killed, that Trump then revived, is at best a step sideways, not forwards. Biden has said outright that he has no interest in a Green New Deal, despite the fact that the watered-down version that bounced around Congress left gaping holes in truly addressing climate chaos. He has also ignored repeated calls to kill both Line 3 and the ill-fated Dakota Access Pipeline. Meanwhile, the executive order to advance racial equity in the federal government grinds sharply against Biden and Harris' own political histories, while, much like Pelosi's toothless climate crisis committee, it offers up no real action to address the issues at hand. The same is true of Biden's call to defend DACA, the Obama-era legislation that granted a renewable two-year stay of deportation for children who immigrated to the U.S. with their parents. As DACA recipient Ila Mendoza explained back in 2017, DACA was flawed from the very beginning. Mendoza described a carrot-and-stick program that demanded recipients sign admissions of illegal border crossings for momentary reprieves that could be overturned at any time. The convenient announcement of DACA around Obama's re-election just highlighted for Mendoza that this was really about dismissing Obama's deportation of more than 2 million people just in time for Election Day. "You can't tell me it's about children all you want, but you're deporting our parents," she said. In short, DACA wasn't a dream come true. While people like Mendoza struggled to build a life under the gaze of the deporter-in-chief, Obama was only too glad to throw other children in cages, a practice many only found abhorrent when Trump did years later. DACA isn't comprehensive immigration reform. It never was. Establishment Democrats and their fans cooing over it like the return of a lost child doesn't change that fact. Looking ahead, many might feel a sense of relief that Biden at least takes the COVID-19 pandemic seriously, signing executive orders to mandate masks in federal buildings, to rejoin the World Health Organization, and to address the financial freefall impacting millions of Americans. However, if you look closely, you will see again that unfulfilling Democratic garnish is sprinkled on deep systematic rot. The executive order to extend the CDC's eviction and foreclosure moratorium until March 31st doesn't address the loopholes in the original order that still allow for evictions. Furthermore, the moratorium does not cancel rent. Tenants will still be liable to pay for all missed payments once the moratorium ends, and landlords are still allowed to hike their rent during the unpaid month. Likewise, the pause on student loan payments demonstrates yet again how little the Democrats are willing to help the people. The move carries over a pause, which Trump administration has started asserting that Biden will carry through on his campaign pledge to cancel $10,000 of student loans per borrower, noting, however, that it will take time as the cancellation has to go through Congress first. Great! So, we've got a Trump leftover plus an empty promise to shave off $10,000 in student loans when the average debt sits at $32,731, and that's not including accrued interest. Biden's executive order is essentially a post-it note IOU with a smiley face scribbled on the back. It kicks the can over to Congress in the hopes we won't realize that Biden could actually cancel all $1.7 trillion in student debt with a different, read actually, useful executive order. Of course, the fact of the matter is that Biden, the mastermind of the 94 crime bill, has no interest in advancing racial equity. He's never cared about the plight of people drowning in debt or drowning in rising floodwaters, and he doesn't care now. He has no intention of progressing or changing the direction of his political career. Indeed, he quite glibly announced to rich donors back in 2019 that nothing will fundamentally change when he takes the Oval Office. Based on his cabinet picks and his first orders as president, Americans should take him as his word. The relief that Trump is gone is understandable. But don't be lulled by the very conditions that gave rise to Trump's presidency in the first place. To celebrate the so-called return to a democracy Americans never had with a decency that is at best shallow, and at worst, a convenient cover-up for crimes against humanity speaks of a belief in American exceptionalism that is neither warranted nor helpful. Underneath the progressive platitudes, an unfulfilling garnish lie the same systematic rot, a rot that was perhaps most noticeable on Inauguration Day itself, when two roads stood sharply demarcated by militarized checkpoints and a revolving door of red and blue capitalist imperialism was almost literally visible. There is no peaceful transition for a country with the largest military and surveillance system the world has ever seen. There is no peaceful transition for a country that represents 5% of the world's population but 25% of the world's incarcerated. There is no peaceful transition for a nation where slavery is still legalized, where millions have died due to lack of healthcare, housing, and other basic human rights. The revolving door of imperialist capitalist preservation turns again, but there is nothing peaceful about it, and the hope that flows from the twisted tongues of American politicians is not hope for the American people. Still, that doesn't mean that there is no hope. Indeed, quite the opposite.
The Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, on the last day of the Trump administration, U.S. and the UAE signed a deal with Washington agreeing to sell planes and drones to Abu Dhabi. The UAE will purchase up to 50 F-35 jets, 18 armed drones, and other weapons. Well, the deal is worth $23 billion. The okay from Washington has come after the UAE agreed with the U.S.'s pushing Abu Dhabi to recognize Israel and establish relations with Tel Aviv, which it did. Now, the UAE embassy in Washington, upon announcing the sale, has said that the UAE is committed to de-escalation in the region. We'll take a look at what all of this may mean on this debate. Stay tuned.
Just hours before his term as the 45th U.S. president ended, Donald Trump finalized a controversial arms deal with the United Arab Emirates. The UAE embassy in Washington confirmed signing a $23 billion worth of an arms deal with the U.S. It said Washington has agreed to deliver 50 F-35 jets, 18 armed drones, and other defense equipment. The F-35 jets are a major piece of the weapons deal, which was awarded to Abu Dhabi in return for a normalization deal with Israel. The UAE had long sought the means to purchase F-35 jets, but failed to do so until the Trump administration came into picture. The armed drones purchase is also a significant one. Experts believe it would be the second largest sale of U.S. drones to a single country. The arms deal came despite massive oppositions in and outside the U.S. In December, there were two attempts to block portions of the UAE sale. Both of them failed despite growing calls from anti-war and human rights groups to halt it. Critics of the deal believe that these weapons would likely be used to inflict harm in Libya and Yemen and could further destabilize West Asia. The UAE has been one of the main players of the Saudi-led coalition that waged a years-long war against Yemen. Abu Dhabi is also involved in the Libya conflict, where the absence of a unified government brought several countries in the war zone with the aims of controlling the oil-rich country. It has also supplied weapons to militant groups in Syria. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump has been pushing for several arms deals in his final weeks in power. First came the approval of $290 million worth of bombs for Saudi Arabia on December 29. On the same day, the State Department also announced a $4 billion sale of Apache helicopters to Kuwait. There was also a $104 million deal for defense equipment to outfit the plane of Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi and another $65.6 million in precision targeting equipment for Egyptian warplanes. Critics blame Washington for supporting wars and destruction by selling arms to nations that have been destabilizing West Asia. They also warn against the possibility of creating an arms race, which will cause nothing but more deaths and chaos.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this debate, journalist and author Daniel Lazar out of New York and journalist and political commentator Syed Mohsen Abbas out of London. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in New York. Daniel, why do you think this deal was not inked until the last day of Trump's reign?
Well, Trump wanted to slip it in under the wire before Biden took office, so to present the new administration with a fait accompli, making it harder for Biden to back away from the deal. I don't think Biden will back away from the deal because I think he basically agrees with the logic of Trump's foreign policy, which is to arm the Gulf states against Iran.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask you if you thought that Biden actually wanted to back away from that deal, but you've answered it. So, Mohsen, initially Israel didn't agree for the UAE to buy the F-35. So you think that was a ploy on its part, or did it later become convinced that it should? Your assessment of that side of things?
I think the assessment has probably changed to some degree. They've decided that they need their erstwhile silent partners, the UAE, the Saudi Arabians, Jordan, all of those buffer Muslim countries, including Egypt as well, amongst that. they've decided that they need them now to act as a physical buffer. And I think that they've initiated that partly with the Saudis' war on Yemen. You can see it there. You can see that the UAE has been commissioned to enter Yemen as well, and they've been also committing atrocities and violating that state's sovereignty. They've also, significantly, the UAE is also being allowed to start building up ports across the region. I think Somalia, Ethiopia, they've been trying to get ports at Socotra, the island just off Yemen. So you can see that there's an expansionism. And the UAE, I think from an Israel point of view, is a sort of major, it's a necessity now. Previously, perhaps they thought by handing over this equipment, it might not be reliable, it could end up in the wrong hands, and they didn't trust them. What's more likely is that the Israeli Defense Force, the American military, are taking hands-on control of all of this this weaponry. Yeah, and it's also a backdoor way of them passing more weaponry to Syrian front and to the Yemeni front as well, I imagine. But the UAE has been a significant purchaser of US military equipment for obviously years. The latest agreement, Defense Cooperation Agreement, came into force on May the 24th, 2019. And since then, the US has been pumping out $28.1 billion in active government-to-government sales cases with the UAE under foreign military sales systems. So there's a lot of financial activity on the military front that's been going on. And of course, the double whammy is that America, which is economically, of course, troubled as well, is using the Arab states as a cash cow to milk them for sale of military hardware. Of course, this goes into the American economy as well. Israel, I think their purpose is really to bolster up these states as more practical frontline partners for them against what they will see as the axis of resistance threat.
Okay. Well, Daniel, the UAE already spends around $30 billion on its annual military budget. Iran spends around $17 billion annually. Even if Abu Dhabi considers Tehran as an adversary, it already spends almost twice the amount that Iran spends on its military budget. Why do you think that's the case? What does it all mean?
Well, I think that the other guess is correct. And I think that the UAE wants to transform itself into a regional military power, a regional military, economic, and strategic power. It's establishing bases down the Red Sea into the Arabian Sea. It's trying to extend its clout throughout the region, and certainly bolstering its military is one way of doing that. It wants to be a big league player. And the U.S. sees nothing wrong with that. The U.S. rather likes the idea, because Saudi Arabia is obviously deeply unstable. So therefore, the U.S. could use a substitute in that region. But I must emphasize that it's all part of a grand orchestrated strategic offensive aimed at isolating Iran and Iran's allies in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon.
Said Mohsen, the UAE embassy in Washington has said that it is committed to de-escalation in the region. Now, it does not appear that the amount of planes and drones that it will be acquiring is going to be used for this de-escalation. Your take on what is said, and actually we see the transaction that is going to be made.
Absolutely right. I mean, we can see from Joe Biden's posturing that he's already now going to review all these contracts and deals, so he says. But that review is, I think, going to be one of going through the motions. And in fact, I think the indication is that they're not happy with the Trump plan to de-escalate what little there was. You know, in Iraq, they were pulling out troops, ostensibly 2,500 troops out of 5,000, officially on record. We don't know the reality. So I don't think Biden has a track record which gives us any hope that he's going to change the Trump policy. In fact, it could be much, much worse. His track record is very much for supporting the beginning of wars, far more likely, some would say, than Donald Trump starting a war with the Islamic Republic or opening up new fronts against the resistance axis. You see, of course, the UAE, Biden will look at this, and during his term in the American administration, he's overseen the Afghanistan and Iraq campaigns, the expeditionary participants, and the UAE is actually in that global coalition, hook, line, and sinker. They co-lead the Global Coalition's Communications Working Group, for instance, providing what the US State Department says is strong support for counter-messaging and countering violent extremism through its Sawab and Hidayah centers, and also a co-lead of the Coalition Stabilization Working Group. So they're very much at the heart of this. It's all done under the guise that the UAE is helping America fight the war on terror. In fact, the reality is that they are probably part and parcel of the mechanism for the Americans and the Israelis keeping control of that region.
So what you're saying, Said Mohsen, basically, if I understand you, is that under a Biden administration, the situation will probably get worse than in the region because, as a matter of fact, de-escalation is going to be the last thing on the agenda. Is that what you're saying?
I think so. I don't think you can see the juggernaut, the industrial military arms complex that the U.S. Spearheads needs these wars. They need these conflicts. They rely on them. You know, $7.5 trillion has gone into these wars over the last 20 or 30 years. That's a conservative estimate that we have. We know that they're signing off on more of these contracts. What we're seeing today is the latest of that. But, you know, prior to what the Americans have been trying to sign off here, they've had CH-47F cargo helicopters, terminal high-altitude area defense, the THAAD missiles, as they're known, and also newly refurbished AH-64E helicopters, large aircraft, infrared countermeasures. You know, it goes on these systems. You know, they even have Blackjack unmanned air vehicles, the Patriot sort of Javelin AIM-9X Sidewinder. I could go on. The list of actual really nasty military hardware is endless. And, you know, they've authorized, as I said earlier, permanent export of over $7.2 billion in defense articles to the UAE via their direct commercial sales process. That's an admission by the U.S. State Department. You don't know what's going on the black market, of course. Right. Whatever's going on the side, it's a different story.
Well, Daniel, as you said earlier, and also said Mohsen, that basically what Washington is doing is trying to threaten Iran. So I want to look at that side of things. In a new Biden administration, do you think that this is the line that's going to be continued, that they want to create more pressure against Iran? Or do you see a possibility of the Biden administration going in a different direction?
I believe it's the former. I think that the Biden administration will maintain as hard a line against Iran as the Trump administration, if not even harder. I mean, it's determined to do the bidding of Israel as much as Trump did, and Israel has just one priority. It sees Iran as its strategic enemy, the most dangerous force in the middle in the entire region. It wants Iran beaten back. Even, you know, to the point of imposing regime change. The U.S. has happily joined in that, you know, in that viewpoint, and I don't see Biden really differing from that at all.
Mm-hmm.
Even Biden's rhetoric about the JCPOA. I mean, Biden has made it clear that he will only re-enter the JCPOA if he's able to gain further concessions from Iran regarding its support for the Syrian government, Hezbollah, Shiite forces in Iraq, and of course the Houthis in Yemen. So Biden is determined to increase the diplomatic pressure on Iran over what Trump had already imposed.
Do you see, Daniel, staying with what you've just said, do you see this new administration more or less pro-Zionist than the previous administration?
At least as much as the previous administration, if not more so. The alliance between the U.S. and Israel just gets closer and closer. And that means that the U.S. adopts Israel's most militant attitudes vis-a-vis Iran. So I just don't see any hope for any kind of, you know, realignment in the Persian Gulf I just see an ever tougher stance on the part of the U.S.
Well, Said Mohsen, some experts say that Abu Dhabi sold out its Palestinian brethren for basically $23 billion worth of military equipment and accepted to normalize relations with Israel. Your take on that assessment, and overall, what does it mean? Not only, of course, we saw that with the UAE, but we also saw it with Sudan and Saudi Arabia and Bahrain.
Well, of course, the American policy in the Middle East is primarily, obviously, for raping oil and resources of that region. Secondly, to maintain dictators and leaders who basically don't give individual sovereignty to those nations, but rather support the interests of Israel and America. That's been going on for decades. And finally, of course, as we said, the cash cow business of taking arms sales is now the more obvious one. So, look, the thing is, I think that the bottom line is that the UAE and this normalization process was part of really that entire overall American and Israeli joint policy in the region. It's just now that they've really called in their, if you like, their erstwhile silent partners to come into openly normalizing. And what the UAE is doing is essentially putting all of its eggs in the basket of the Zio-American imperialist powers in that region. And, of course, it is on the borders of Iran, well, on the sea borders, at least. And that poses, a huge threat for Iran. It also poses a problem for the UAE, because if the saber-rattling that goes on between Israel and Iran, or America and Iran, continues, and somebody, you know, decides to take a rash move, of course, these bases in the UAE are some of the bases which will launch any possible attacks on Iran. And Iran and the establishment has already made it very, very clear several times. The administration has made it clear that the allies of Israel, those who are normalizing Israel's apartheid in Palestine, those who are supporting terrorist organizations across the Middle East, those who are undermining the independence and integrity of the people of the region, the ordinary citizens, are on their target list as well. And if anything happens to Tehran, or anything happens to the major nerve centers of certainly the Islamic Republic, the UAE, Abu Dhabi, etc., will all be number one on the hit list. And Tel Aviv, of course, it has also been warned. So it is a really fragile situation, and the world really needs to take note. There's an ambivalence in America, there's an ambivalence across the world stage in this Cold War, or this Hot War, which is actually being played out as well, simultaneously. But the world is going to ill afford to ignore this for very much longer, because it only takes a little mistake, a little calculation to go wrong. Mm-hmm. And what we can see happen with the case of General Soleimani and the tolerance and the patience that the Islamic Republic employed by only attacking one or two American sites could run out, and they may be forced to go further. The military exercises in the Gulf, the American B-52s that have been flying to and from, these military sales to the UAE, all of this is the drums of war,
okay.
Something which I think the whole international community has to step in and to de-escalate.
Daniel, your assessment of it all, you just heard Said Mohsen talk about it only takes a spark to basically light up the whole area. With the situation, we see the increase of weapons being sold by Washington or London to these regional countries. Your assessment of the possibility of even further destabilization?
Well, it's very hard to predict, but I think in the long run, we can safely say that the likelihood is steadily rising. I mean, the U.S. is assembling its anti-Iranian coalition. It is stuffing the region filled with arms, ever more so. The area is bristling with weaponry, and it just takes a spark to set off the conflagration. And we don't know what will happen. It was, you know, it didn't happen after the assassination of Soleimani. Didn't happen after the assassination of the Iranian nuclear scientist. But the next incident could. It's so hard to predict, but the general trend seems clear. The situation is growing more and more dangerous.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with us on this debate. Journalist and author Daniel Lazar out of New York and journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Thanks so much for being with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The Europeans' empty promises after the U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
The Europeans didn't do anything. Their last miracle was a stupid game called Instex, which has not become operational yet. It has not been put in place yet. In sum, Instex means that Iran should give to their European excellencies, for example, to the French and the English, the money that the others owe to us so that they will buy every product that they deem good and send it to Iran. This is what Instex means. This is a wrong measure in itself, but they have not fulfilled this very promise either. The cure for sanctions is to activate domestic capacities. Of course, this requires hard work and diligence. We should work hard. This is another point.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
I wish to say something about the economic issues of the country. Well, the country has certain problems in terms of people's livelihood issues. Families really have serious livelihood problems. Prices are high, and this should be remedied. Of course, I have spoken to officials in private meetings, or I have sent them messages about the things that should be done. I have spoken to Mr. President, and I have also sent messages to other officials so that they will do certain things. However, I wish to stress again that the organizations in charge should pay attention to this point. In the area of economic problems, certain issues are urgent, and certain issues require long-term and mid-term measures.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.